time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for Saturday, January 26th, 2019. Ice and snow, frigid air, and thoughts begin to wander towards spring and getting off the trainer and back outdoors. So I thought I'd take your mind off the weather and give you a little history this week with an extended conversation with Sean Petty. Beginning in 1985, when Sean joined the Southland Corporation and became part of that era of great American competitive cycling with the likes of Greg LeMond, Davis Finney, and Andy Hampston, and up until today, where he still serves on the boards of USA Cycling and the UCI, he maintains a remarkable and unique perspective about our sport. We start our conversation way back at the beginning of his career and bring it right up to the present day, where his obvious love of the sport will see the first all-women's UCI pro race here in the States this summer. Before we get to Sean's interview, though, I thought it was important to bring Steve Frothingham, the editor of Bicycle Retailer, onto the show to talk about how the government shutdown is affecting the bicycle industry and perhaps you. The CPSC, Consumer Product Safety Commission, is running on a skeleton crew, and there are two bicycle recalls that have not been issued because of the shutdown. Here's Steve to tell us about those recalls and what else might be happening with the lack of government oversight. Hi, Steve. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me back, Dan.
Oh, it is my pleasure. So you wrote an article for Bicycle Retailer on January 18th titled, "Partial government shutdown means CPSC is not announcing recalls." And you relay information that might not be getting out to the general public. So I think we should find out what's going on with the CPSC or not going on, as the case may be.
Okay. Well, hearing you say that makes me think I need to hire a new headline writer because it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. But
it's a little long, but what can I
say? Yeah. But I needed to be careful because I didn't want to imply that recalls are being delayed in any way. Both companies that are mentioned in the story emphasize that they have been in communication with the CPSC and that their recalls were mostly proceeding as normal. And both those companies are pretty experienced with doing recalls. But CPSC is part of the partial government shutdown. And as near as I can tell, there are 20 employees working there now during the shutdown out of quite a bit more than 500 normally.
Wow.
So that's a very small staff. And the official directive is that they are only to work on product issues that, quote, create a substantial and immediate threat to the safety of human life, end quote.
Okay. I can't wait to hear the two recalls for the bicycle industry.
Yeah. So, I guess apparently since neither of those recalls has been announced by the CPSC, they do not create a substantial or immediate threat to safety of human life, even though I would think a failing brake on a bike would threaten my safety. But what's happened is that CPSC is still in touch with companies that are preparing to issue a recall. But they clearly are not announcing recalls through their normal channels, which is a big part of what they do. They haven't announced a recall of any kind of product since December 20th, which is when the shutdown began. And that's very unusual.
So manufacturers are still mandated in a way to somehow contact people or let them know that there has been a recall. It does have to go to the CPSC for an official recall, but if a bike dealer knows he or she sold this bike to that client and the recall comes through from, say, Specialized or SRAM in this case, can't they contact them and that is okay too?
Yeah, they can. That works fine. And especially with a company like SRAM or Specialized, they're pretty experienced and they know how to run a recall properly. I'm a little more concerned about a smaller company, a younger company that maybe hasn't had to deal with a recall before.
Sure.
They might not even know they're supposed to notify the CPSC, and they might not know the best way to conduct a recall. Theoretically, that's not the best situation for our bike riding friends. That's not the best situation for the company because it might open them up to legal issues down the road. And if nothing else, in a normal situation, if a small company issued a recall on their own, they would probably get contacted pretty quickly by the CPSC saying, hey, you know, you're supposed to be working with us. I've seen that happen over the years.
Oh, they monitor that then?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of cases over the years at Bicycle Retailer where I will get a recall notice that came from a company instead of from the CPSC. And a lot of times I will get another recall notice a few weeks later from the CPSC because the CPSC learned about the recall. I know for a fact that there are some people at CPSC that read our website and get our magazine. Or they find out about it other ways. Companies are required by law to notify the CPSC if they have a product that doesn't meet CPSC safety rules or which has a defect that could create a safety problem. They're required to report it within 24 hours, actually.
Okay, that answers one of my questions, that you are required to report it. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Steve Frothingham from Bicycle Retailer and Industry News, and we're talking about two recalls that the CPSC hasn't been able to get out there because of the government shutdown. So can we just mention the two recalls and what listeners might want to do if they have these products?
Okay. SRAM is recalling a 3-speed coaster brake rear hub that was included on some Electra cruiser bikes. Apparently the coaster brake can fail under some situations, and they are recalling the bikes in particular that don't have another handbrake in addition to the coaster brake.
Okay, so they have just a rear brake, not a front brake.
Yeah. They're doing something unusual. I haven't seen this before, where they're, at least in Canada, they are offering to buy back the bike from the consumer.
Interesting.
At Bicycle Blue Book resale value. I've never seen that before. But I guess, replacing a rear 3-speed hub on a bike that maybe only sells for $300 or $400, it would probably cost more to replace that hub than the bike is worth.
Why not just replace the rear wheel? They could probably make that cheaply.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know.
I think they're giving the option if somebody really loves their bike, they can arrange with a dealer to do a fix with a whole new rear wheel.
And the Specialized recall?
The Specialized is sort of at the other end because they're recalling thousands of fairly pricey road bikes that have the Future Shock front suspension feature because of a relatively small part, just a little collar that clamps around this gear tube. And apparently that collar can crack and break, which would cause a lot of problems. And so it's a relatively small item, relatively easy to swap it out, but it involves thousands of bikes and they're fairly expensive. So it's a pretty significant recall. I know that they are recalling about 5,000 bikes in Canada and about 5,000 bikes in Australia. But one of the things I don't know is how many they're recalling in the U.S.
Go figure.
I haven't seen that CPSC recall notice yet.
Because they're on shutdown. Oh, my gosh.
Right. But both companies are doing a great job. They are working with other countries, including Canada, to issue recalls, and they are, of course, promoting the recalls through their own channels, through their dealers, website, Twitter, etc. It does raise the question of the CPSC recall notices have a really huge audience. The media, mainstream media, monitors those recalls. They'll pop up on, Good Morning America, major newspapers, and it really gets the word out in a quick way. Much wider audience than, Bicycle Retailer Magazine. So, so it raises the question of, is there somebody out there riding an unsafe product because this recall notice did not go out the way it normally did?
In our litigious society.
Yeah.
The CPSC something with the shutdown may slow imports of some products. Explain how that happens, because it's Customs and Border Protection that usually monitors ports of entry, right?
Mm-hmm. I believe that CPSC probably does spot checks and checks where they have a reason to believe that a particular shipment might contain some unsafe products. Clearly, they don't have enough staff to be inspecting every container full of bicycle helmets that comes in. But that's one issue that they have enforced in the past is, you know, bicycle helmets sold in the U.S. are required to meet the CPSC helmet standard.
Right.
There's been a few instances over the years where somebody has imported a helmet from Asia or somewhere overseas that didn't meet that standard, didn't have the sticker in it. In some cases, it might be a helmet that's sold in Europe that meets the CEN standard in Europe, but doesn't meet the CPSC standard.
Huh, interesting that there are different standards. I had forgotten that.
Yeah. So I know I've seen some issues of that over the years. So theoretically, that could be allowing some products to come in that don't meet the standards. And of course, there's CPSC standards for bikes, too, as we all know, for the reflectors and other aspects of the bikes. And they could be inspecting shipments on occasion. But I think they're spot checks, so I don't think it's likely to really slow anything down too much.
Are you hearing anything else about the shutdown that is affecting the bicycle? Well, of course, everything that is affecting specifically our business.
You know, last time there was a shutdown, I did a lot of phone calls. I guess I must have had a little more time on my hands back then. And that recall was in 2013.
Right.
It was in October, which is prime riding season in Moab, where there's a lot of national parks. And so that was a big deal out there for the people for the bike shops and people that run guided tours in the national parks and such. And even the Outer Bike event was scheduled for that month. And that was on some federal land outside of Moab. And they had some issues getting permits and stuff. So that had more of an effect back then. This one, obviously, it's timed in December and January. There's not a lot of biking going on, and even in Utah this time of year. So
yes,
I haven't heard much about that being a problem. Maybe in the South, there's some federal lands where that's an issue. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't think about the national parks. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, generally biking, off-road biking generally isn't allowed in national parks, but there is some trail riding on some paths. The other issue that popped up 5 years ago or 6 years ago was the FCC. All our little wireless gadgets, everything from a wireless heart rate monitor to a GPS unit and power meters and all those, all have to have their radio code approved by the FCC or can't be sold on the market. And I know that in 2013, Le Mans Bicycles was coming out with a new smart trainer, and it got delayed because the FCC, it took them 3 or 4 weeks to approve their wireless technology.
Wow.
I have no idea whether there are any bike products that are in the pipeline now that are being delayed, but thinking about how many more gadgets there are in the market now, I wouldn't be surprised if there's something in the pipeline.
Really? So the last thing is about the two recalls, the SRAM recall and the specialized recall. We don't have numbers, we don't have models, we don't have all of that because CPSC usually publishes all of that. If somebody has one of the high-end specialized suspension bikes and or somebody has the three-speed Coaster Brake SRAM hub, without even knowing for sure, should they just go back to a dealer and find out if their product has been recalled?
Yeah, the dealers would know, or you can get on the web. I don't have a good URL that rolls off the tongue to give you, but
okay.
If you go to the specialized website and go to the bottom, there's a safety recalls link, and that'll bring you to the page where they have their information.
Yeah, SRAM probably has the same thing.
SRAM has a similar thing. Cool. You can also go to Healthy Canada, which is the Canadian recall site. And the terms of the recall in Canada are probably slightly different than what they are in the U.S., but it's a place to at least start researching that.
I love starting the year with recalls. It doesn't make me feel good, but it's been already a weird year, you know, with the shutdown and everything else and these crazy storms. And it's, you know, like it's 45 degrees here today and raining. Yesterday it was like 12 and ice everywhere and snow. It's just weird. So why should this be any different? Well, Steve, thank you so much for talking to us about the CPSC and the recalls. Again, Steve Frothingham, bicycle retailer and industry news. Have a great day, and we'll probably talk again.
All right. Thanks a lot, Diane.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Steve Frothingham is the editor of Bicycle Retailer and Industry News. If you think you might have one of the recalled products, please log on to the SRAM or specialized website for more information. So let's take a short break and then we'll settle back for a chat with Sean Petty. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On The Outspoken Cyclist, I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Sean Petty proudly wears a lot of cycling hats, and he has an eternal sense of hope for our sport and its success. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Sean. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Glad to be here, Diane. Thanks.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. You have an amazing background in the sport of cycling, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say. You go way back to 1985. You joined the Southland Corporation. And for those people who don't know, that's the parent corporation for 7-Eleven. And then up until the present, you're still involved in a variety of positions. So give us the cliff notes of Sean Petty's career in the cycling world.
Yeah, it started, as you said, with the Southland Corporation, with the 7-Eleven, who was a major sponsor of cycling from 1980 to 1990. That was surrounding their sponsorship of the Olympic Games in Los Angeles. It kind of grew out of that. And the 7-Eleven team grew out of that support for the Olympics in 84. And then after the tremendous success of cycling in the 1984 Games, nine U.S. riders won medals, and seven of those were on the 7-Eleven team. There's a tremendous amount of momentum and equity and interest in the team, and as they'd done very well. And in 85, when I joined, is when the men's side turned professional, and most of the guys wanted to race in Europe. And that's really where we started, that campaign and did the 1985 Giro d'Italia with a team that was a kind of composite 7-Eleven and other riders. Andy Hampston joined us from another team, Bob Roll, Jock Boyer, another one. So that group was put together with the 7-Eleven team, and we ended up winning two stages there. Ron Kiefel and Andy Hampston, which led to the 86 Tour de France invitation. But I'll get to that later. So, but from that point, the sponsorship ended in 1990, and the company was going through some financial difficulties that eventually led to bankruptcy. But believe it or not, we continued the team for two more years after the company went into bankruptcy. So again, it was the owners loved the team, the riders, everything about it, the men's and women's teams. And it was tough to give it up, but they did. And then after that, I stayed on with the company in the marketing department for a couple of years. And then I was with the Southwest Conference, which was one of the collegiate NCAA conferences that became the Big 12. And then in 94, the USCF, which was then the governing body for the sport, purchased US Pro, which was the separate professional arm. And when that happened, they wanted to bring in a managing director for US Pro. And certainly we had been in that space with the 7-Eleven team and series that we had sponsored and a lot of other areas of sponsorship that I'd been involved in at 7-Eleven. So I started with, which was then USCF, and became USA Cycling in 95. And then from 94 to 2014, I was employed at USA Cycling in various capacities. I headed up the national team program for 4 years, and then became vice president of marketing and chief of staff, then chief operating officer during my tenure there and over pretty much every aspect of the organization at one time or another in my various roles there. And after I left USA Cycling, I consulted there. And then I went on the board of directors in 2014 on USA Cycling, and I'm still on the board of directors there. I was named to the UCI Road Commission in 2005, and I'm now on my fourth four-year term that started in 2017. So been a long time member of that commission and on the board of Bicycle Colorado, which is a bicycle advocacy group here in the state. Yeah, so got a lot of volunteer activity going on, but also, more recently running the women's races at the U.S. Pro Challenge in 2015. And then the last 2 years ran the Women's Colorado Classic. And I'm going to be the race director once again for the Women's Colorado Classic this year. So I think that brings us up to today.
So you can run, but you can't hide from the bicycle world.
No, exactly.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sean Petty. He has an unbelievably wonderful story about bicycling from a very interesting place, I must say. So can we back up to the 7-Eleven team for a second? And you witnessed some history that really has not been repeated by American cyclists. What were some of the highlights of being with that team? Obviously, Greg LeMond, but...
Yeah, Greg, of course. Greg didn't ride for us, but we were certainly there in 1986. We were the first U.S. professional team to be invited and compete in the Tour de France in 86. And, of course, that was the same year that Greg won with La Vie Claire.
Right.
But for us, starting with that 1985 Giro where we won two stages, again, I think there have been other U.S. teams in the Giro. Robin Morton had taken a team over there, and Mike Carter had raced, and some other folks had raced in it. But we had won two stages and kind of launched us into people taking us seriously, which led to the Tour de France invitation in 86. And I think it helped that CBS was televising the tour at the time. So you had an American network and a good American story with our team there, and certainly with Greg. But yeah, that race was amazing. The first day we won the yellow jersey. Alex Steda was in the jersey in the morning. It was a double stage day, short stage, and Alex had a good prologue and had enough time bonuses in that morning stage to take the jersey. And it was interesting. He was actually in 19, that was 86, way ahead of his time. He actually wore a skin suit that day.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was very unusual. So anyway, took a lot of sideways glances at him, and then after he got the jerseys, and he won all the jerseys that day. And so the afternoon was a team time trial, and he was pretty much exhausted from the effort and all of the emotion around winning all the jerseys and all of the things he had to do. And meanwhile, we had a team time trial in the afternoon, and he was suffering early on and almost missed the time cut. So within an 8-hour period, the high of highs to the low of lows. And then the next day, come back up, and Davis Finney wins a road stage, and first American to win a road stage in the Tour de France. So, yeah, it was great. And then from then on, it was getting through that tour. The guys did a great job and pretty much launched everything that we did after that. And I think it helped get a lot of respect, along with Greg, certainly, for American riders in Europe, competing in Europe and making their way, through the peloton and getting respect along the way. So, yeah, that was amazing. And then followed by a lot of wins. The team had some great results over the years, and certainly that was a highlight early on. And then in 1988, when Andy Hampston and the guys won the Giro d'Italia, which, again, is still the only American to have won the Giro.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, for people who follow the sport are very aware of the epic day in the snowstorm on the Gavia Pass. That was I'm sure they wouldn't even do the race today because of the extreme weather protocols. So that stage probably would have been canceled instead of the kind of epic photos and guys getting frostbite. And it was a brutal day, and it was one of those kind of legendary moments for the sport and certainly for Americans and for Andy. So he got in the jersey that day. Eric Breukink actually won the stage. Andy took the jersey and the team held it all the way to the finish.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. So one of the other roles you had was as team manager of the 2000 Olympic cycling team. Was it road and track or the whole cycling team?
Yeah, each sport has a team leader. And I was team leader for that one.
So those games were in Sydney, Australia. Mm-hmm. The team brought home 3 Olympic medals. What do you think the most challenging thing is to manage an Olympic team? I mean, you know, you got a lot of personalities. Well, I'm sure it's just like any other cycling team, but something about the Olympics seems different.
Yeah, it is different. And, you know, because as you said, you have road, track, and mountain bike. So very, very different disciplines who don't often, compete together in the same venue. And obviously the Olympics is that. Of course, now BMX is added to the mix. But
right. They have to deal with that.
Yeah. So we, you know, the one thing that's challenging is obviously you have a lot of different training going on, a lot of people coming and going at different times. And we competed, I think at that time, 14 out of the 16 days. And with the addition of now BMX freestyle to the Tokyo Games, it'll be every day. So they'll be cycling every day in the Olympics in 2020. But in 2000, we had 27 riders, which is still one of the biggest teams we've ever taken to the games. We qualified in pretty much everything in track and in road and mountain bike. So yeah, you've got training going on, people coming in. We had some pre-training in Brisbane and then brought people into Sydney because Sydney was a bit hectic. So you have people finishing their competition, other people coming in, staff, you have mechanics, soigneurs, the doctors, and then integrating with all of the U.S. Olympic Committee folks. It's a logistical challenge for sure. But Sydney was wonderful. You know, it was very Australian in that
right.
It was very fun. It was a very fun celebratory competition and time. Wonderful hosts. We really enjoyed their time there. But it is busy. It's full on for, you know, every day, all day and into the evening, and making sure everyone's where they need to be and healthy and taken care of and have what they need to do their best. And that's what we did. And as I said, the mountain bike was a little farther out, so it has its own challenges and getting people there and on the courses and training. And, you know, the velodrome was in a separate venue. So, again, a lot of logistical pieces that most sports don't have to deal with. They usually deal with one venue, and they're kind of used to going back and forth to that, where we were pretty much all over the place for, you know, 2.5 weeks while we were in Sydney. But amazing experience, a real honor to go march in opening ceremonies. And that's something I'll never forget. It was absolutely electric experience to walk in with the whole U.S. team and feel that energy. It was amazing.
I'll bet. You make me feel like I can feel it. That's pretty cool. So we brought home 3 medals in cycling from the 20 or the 2000 games. What were they?
2000. Yeah, we did. Marty Nelstein won the
track
sprint.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Lance Armstrong was in the time trial, and Mari Holden in the individual time trial.
Hmm. Somehow I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
About Mari Holden. Oh, how interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a hot chick even today.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
And she went on after that to win the world championship in the time trial after the Olympic Games. So
wow.
She went from silver in Sydney to rainbow jersey a few weeks later in France. It was in Plouay. But yeah, she's an amazing athlete.
So let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Sean Petty, and we are talking about cycling going all the way back to 1985, only we're going to bring it forward a little bit. And I want to talk a little bit about USA Cycling, and it was the United States Cycling Federation, the USCF. And you've had a lot of roles that have changed over the years. The organization has changed over the years. What do you think it needs to do now? I know you're still on the board. What do you think it needs to do now to bring the United States back to that kind of cycling glory that we had in 2000 and before?
Yeah, great question, Diane. I mean, that's one we ask ourselves every day.
Only every day.
but, uh, But no, I think you know, certainly there's no question that you know, that Lance was an iconic, powerful personality that brought a lot of attention and certainly a lot of interest in our sport. And I think from USA Cycling standpoint, you know, a lot of membership, we saw it grow from, you know, from about 50,000 to 70,000, you know, over a 5-year period. And again, it certainly correlated with Lance's success at the Tour de France. So, you know, that obviously his story kind of transcended sport and cycling. And as I said, brought an awful lot of attention to us. So I think overall, we don't have someone like Lance or that level of success, you know, that people outside of the sport who got used to seeing the Tour de France. And for some people, that's all they know.
Yeah, that's true.
You and I know, and a lot of the folks who are interested in this probably are aware that really the season goes from January, literally this week in Australia.
Right.
Starting Tour
Down Under.
Exactly. To Lombardia in October. So the Tour, yes, it's important. Yes, it's huge. It's one of the many races in the season. But again, Lance made that big, and Lance, you know, that's what people know. And we haven't had anyone had that type of success or even close to that success. And I think a lot of people who don't follow the sport regularly, you know, attach our popularity or our level of success to that event, which is not fair, but that's what it is. And as I said, we're still very successful. Our women have consistently been, you know, medalists at world championships and on the road, on the track. And then, of course, most recently, you know, Kate Courtney and the mountain bike world champion.
Right.
So, again, women have carried the banner for us consistently for a long time. And I see that's how it will go in the future. So, again, I think we, you know, if there's another big personality that comes in and has big success at something like the Tour de France, it's a shame. It's all measured by that, but it tends to be the case that people are paying attention in July more than the rest of the year. And even though there have been a lot of great results by men and women over the years, it just hasn't broken through the, you know, the rest of the kind of noise and clutter in sports.
Do you think some of it has to do with coverage?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think that having it available, and that's one of the challenges we have on the women's side, is there's a lot of good racing, but it's not available on distribution on TV or even online. That's the biggest push for everyone, is to get it much, much more accessible to everyone. And, you know, more recently also is, how do we make it more interesting, more exciting, more, you know, getting more eyeballs on it with data from the race and just, you know, shorter stages. So all these things that are happening over the last few years that you've seen in some of the races like the Tour, it's looking, we can't continue to present it the same way. And how do we make it presentable to a group that's not always interested in a 6-hour stage perhaps, but follows enough, and how do we present that and make it interesting on the viewer side? And then certainly on USA Cycling side, you know, the number of races and number of members has decreased over the last couple of years. So, you know, there's a challenge of how do we create more races? How do we, you know, get more members and interest people in something that's even outside of bike racing? Because obviously we've been focused forever as an organization on the racing and the infrastructure of racing in the United States. And now we're looking to broaden that appeal and interest to those that are maybe just doing grand fondos and fun rides and gravel grinders. So kind of expanding that, how can we be relevant? How can USA Cycling be relevant to those folks who are active on their bikes, but not necessarily racing?
All right. I want to take a real quick break because I want to pursue something that goes along with that. Is that okay? Can we take a break?
Sure.
Okay. Hang on a second. So we are speaking with Sean Petty. He's out in Colorado. Of course, that's where Cycling Mecca is, for USA Cycling and for all the other Colorado cool stuff going on. And, you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Okay, we're right back. And if you are just joining me, I've been speaking with Sean Petty. He is, he has so many hats, I can't even decide which hat to talk to you about. But go back and listen to the beginning of our conversation. He is really well known within the professional cycling industry, especially racing. So we were talking about how to perhaps change USA Cycling to expand its scope so that it's not just about road racing or track racing or sprint or even crit racing, but to include more people. Tell me more about that. What are you doing to change the way people look at racing? I know the Grand Fondo is one way. So are there sanctioned, are they are sanctioned Grand Fondos? Is that how they work?
Diane, yeah. 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 USA Cycling has a good permits and event insurance for all sorts of cycling events, whether it's a, like I say, Grand Fondo or fun ride or charity ride, whatever might be. They actually, it's a very robust insurance package that obviously protects the organizer and the folks who put the effort behind it, but as well as those who might get injured along the way. So as I said, it's a very good package there, and plugs you into the membership of USA Cycling. A lot of people don't think about it. Maybe they do one ride a year, and USA Cycling has been the racing organization. But again, we're trying to make it where a lot of those folks who were members, lifestyle or life demands, took them out of the racing, but they're still probably riding as much as ever, just doing other things. And how do we stay connected to them? How do we give them something of value to continue to be a member? We created a ride membership a couple of years ago. It's growing slowly. Again, it's going to take a lot more marketing to a value proposition to those that don't race and say, well, here's why it would be good to get a membership in USA Cycling. Here are the benefits to that. So that's the challenge today. And that for our new CEO coming in, who we're really excited about, Rob DeMartini coming on board from New Balance. Someone in that space of marketing and that's really what we're looking at, and I think something we desperately needed for quite a while to get us outside of the racing community, so to speak, and while still ensuring that we focus on the core business, which has always been the infrastructure of race organizers and officials and all the infrastructure for bike racing in the United States. That's still vitally important to the organization, because ultimately all of that feeds the athlete pipeline, which we're responsible for the world championships and Olympic games.
I have a question about track racing. So Joan Hanscom is taking over or has taken over the stewardship of the Trexler Town Velodrome over in Pennsylvania. Actually, I'll be talking with her this week.
Fantastic.
What a cool lady. And I'm wondering, going back to a little bit, I've always had this in my mind that track racing to me is the perfect spectator sport for the U.S. audience. Sit in the stands, drink your beer, eat your hot dogs, and watch people crash on the track, which of course that's not what we want, but that is what happens. And it's sort of like football on wheels. What do you think about the idea that more tracks might attract more people?
It's a great question. And I agree with you. I think having that fixed venue, it's very easy to follow. Most of the races are easy to understand. And I think for many, many, many years, as you know, Diane, I think T-Town's done such an amazing job. And those Friday nights there were part of the fabric of the community and always pack the Velodrome for the racing on Friday nights and a great community support, a great community activity. And they've proven that they can do that over the years. So it's a little surprising it hasn't caught on in other parts of the country. There's a lot of value, certainly in track racing, in developing riders and developing all sorts of skills that road riders, mountain bike rider, any type of rider can use. We just haven't seen the big numbers going out and getting on the track. I think once people do, they realize it's easier than it looks, and it's fun, and certainly you're not out on the roads, but offers a lot of opportunity for some really interesting types of racing, as you said, that's fun to watch and pretty easy to understand.
I know part of the problem, of course, is you have to build a track, but there was a robust track circuit and then it sort of died out, and maybe it'll come back. I don't know. But anyway, I just thought I'd ask the question of somebody who's a little closer to, you know, that core racing community. So we're going to take a left turn or a right turn or whichever way we're going around the track. And I want to talk about something that I hate talking about, and yet I think we still need to talk about. You also serve with the UCI, and you are the only member of the organization outside of Europe. You've served on the UCI board for many years. And doping, I think, is still a concern of professionals. It's actually trickling down into, you know, things like citizen fondos, which makes no damn sense to me whatsoever. So tell me about, you know, it's like playing whack-a-mole. One drug gets banned and something else pops up. And so what is it going to take? Or is there anybody who says, you know what, we just are going to ignore it? I mean, you can't really ignore it. How is it going to clean up the sport? And that may be part of the problem with people not watching it after what happened with Armstrong.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. There was definitely – that had a big impact, no question. Everyone loved Lance's stories, certainly success, but more – probably equally important was the cancer survivor and you know, coming back from near death. So I think everybody felt let down, obviously, from that. But – you know, there's no question, and having been involved in the sport as long as I've been, you know, that the cycling has and continues to do more than any other sport in the world in terms of the fight against doping. I'm confident of that. You know, the blood tests years and years ago, the biological passport was started years ago for the World Tour and the Pro Continental teams. Obviously, a huge number of out of competition and in competition tests. I laugh when I see the NFL players or Serena Williams complaining about, you know, 4 or 5 tests a year, you know, when Chris Froome will get tested probably 19 times in the Tour de France alone. I mean, so it's important to the teams because it's obviously the lifeblood of their sponsorship. I think the sponsors have zero tolerance for that. So teams can't afford to look the other way. You know, I do believe it's been dramatically cleaned up and continues down that road. And it's a very, very difficult sport, no question about it. We should at least take credit for doing more than pretty much any other sport. And the athletes are available, you know, 24/7, 365. And anyone in the out of competition testing pool, which are most of the well-known athletes, they've got to be available, again, 24/7, 365. And guarantee at least 1 hour a day they are going to absolutely 100% be where they say they will be. So
yeah, it's pretty strict.
It is. It is. I don't. And you know, if you know something comes up, an emergency or something, and the tester shows up, you've got some explaining to do. So you know, I mean, yes, people have found ways around it and things like this, but in general, it is very, very, very difficult. And I think that's the direction the sport has moved, and I think the strides have been huge. Is it cleaned up? I think people would be naive to say that, but it's a long, long way and much, much better than it has been. And I think at the highest levels, sure, we're seeing people pop, but unfortunately that's a human element that people cheat on their taxes. They run stop signs.
They text while they drive. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so it's, yes, there's rules, but you know, and again, the higher the stakes, then for some people, the more they're willing to risk or at least take those chances. And so, but at least now where if someone's dope there and get caught, chances are they're not going to get a contract, you know, after that. So we're seeing, you know, the teams committed to it and their sponsors are, I think, of zero tolerance, at least, you know, as much as they can be and know what's going on. So, you know, again, great strides have been made, and I think we should be proud of that. But it's always vigilant, and we recently went into the, you know, equipment and technological fraud with the bikes. And
oh, I forgot.
Yeah, we got ahead of that. Again, you haven't seen anything, but instead of waiting for something, now we've got an expanded program. Bikes are being X-rayed. The UCI will increase the number of they're literally a trailer that will go to events and they will X-ray bikes all the time. So again, besides the iPad motor detection device they had, those are everywhere. Some people argue how effective those are, but now the next step is to ensure, and it's really just to let people know, look, we're eliminating that possibility. And, you know, you haven't seen anything in a major race with a motor in their bike. So, or at least get caught, let's put it that way. And they seem to be on top of it, actually ahead of it. So, you know, again, I think the sports vigilant, we realize the impact that had, and certainly Lance's case, huge impact, and others in that era, I would say. We've seen, you know, Germany stopped broadcasting the Tour de France because of all the issues that were with Jan Ulrich and other riders, German riders. So we've now seen it come back. It's back in Germany by German television. So, again, I think we're seeing the numbers are on TV are impressive again, and people are engaged in the sport, but we're always vigilant.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
You mentioned the word sponsors, and I'm always interested in the whole idea of sponsorship versus marketing versus, and maybe it's not versus, sponsorship and marketing and television and all of that. Sponsors tend to drop off, come on, drop off, come on. What is it that makes a sponsor take on a team and then drop it? What is it the sponsor is looking for that he or she didn't know he was or wasn't going to get?
That's good. Good question, Diane. Well, I think, you know, traditionally, you know, good news, bad news for the sport. Traditionally, there's someone at that corporation at whatever level that might be that certainly has an interest in cycling. In almost every case, you've got someone who's that advocate inside the company and has the ability to push that forward and you know, get those funds committed to the sport. We've had that challenge of getting past those internal warriors and just saying, look, here's the value proposition for cycling. Here's the numbers on TV. And certainly, you know, you take the Tour de France, they've done that. I mean, they have huge television rights and the sponsorships are very large because again, the viewership numbers are globally are very impressive compared to any other event. And over a 3-week period, you know, you almost can't duplicate that anywhere. So the Tour is its own. Outside of that, you know, most of the races, when people start talking about revenue sharing, there's not a lot of revenue in these other races outside of the Tour de France, even the Giro, even the Vuelta, any of the big, even one day races that people know. Most of the time people are now paying for television production and a lot of other costs that police costs and things like this, they didn't used to have. So, but back to the sponsor proposition, it's still coming down to someone who believes in the sport, believes in the value and the association with it that it brings to their company. And as I said, we just haven't proven to have a template that says, here's the value. If we lose this company, it's easy to find another one to plug in. We can easily tell that story on what the return on investment is because there are no ticket sales. The TV is all over the board. There's not one central league. The teams kind of come and go. So the story is more of a challenge than the professional leagues here in the U.S. And you don't have bundled efforts on TV, on marketing, and everybody's really outselling their own property and obviously against each other and against other sports and other activities. So the attempt now from the UCI is to bring all the parties together, the teams, the organizers, and the UCI, and create some events. One of them will be the UCI Classic Series that we'll schedule to kind of launch in 2020. And all three of those stakeholder groups came together, UCI, teams, organizers, and are going to share revenue, share promotion, and create a series of one-day races. It'll be a lot of the existing ones, but everybody's agreed to come together and work together, and that's what it's going to take. It's going to take that effort to combine assets and make the pie bigger, and then you've got something to sell, and then you've got a more coherent product to sell sponsors.
Interesting. Just such a good explanation, one that makes so much sense. You know, I look at golf because my father was a golfer, and even though I don't play the sport, I watch those tournaments and see the amount of money that they actually just give to charity. And I'm wondering, how the hell are they doing that? You know, and again, it's individual golfers, but they're all sponsored.
No, you're right. Obviously, the big opportunity they have, they've got a dedicated TV partner, and they're usually paying. And then they've got those sponsors. And then, of course, they're selling tickets.
That's true.
Those are all of those things. And concession. Then the concessions part is fairly significant as well.
Aha, back to track racing. See, back to track.
Yeah, no, you're right. That at least you got an opportunity there at track or BMX. BMX can provide a similar venue, but you're right. It's whereas the side of the road, people have tried and tried. And, you know, if you say you're going to shut down Alpe d'Huez and charge, you're going to see you're going to see a lot of open road from the bottom to the top.
Right. It doesn't work that way. So I have one more topic to discuss, and it's about your new race, the race for the women. Couple things about it. One is women have been talking about parity for a long time. And I'm starting to see that women are getting paid to race again. And I can remember talking with people like Inga Thompson and Karen Bliss. And, you know, in those days, they actually did get money to race. Now it's been tougher. Tell me about your race coming up, your women's race in Colorado.
Yeah. No, you're right. And go back because Inga was with us 7-Eleven and I think we paid more back in 1986 and 87 than some of the women get today, which is shocking. So, but you're right, Diane. I think that, you know, the one thing when Brian Cookson came in at UCI 5 years ago, I mean, the women's, you know, mandate to support and grow the women's side was important to him, and he really lived it. And I think David Lapartien, who is now the new president, has carried that as well. So we've seen a lot of momentum. The women's commission there at UCI is strong. And for us on the road commission, it's been very critical part of our meetings for the last 5-6 years as well. So we've seen that push. We've seen in terms of the creation of the Women's World Tour events, the structure of the teams is changing. We're pushing for a minimum salary. We can't push something that the teams can't handle,
right,
but we have to aspire to make it that level. There are minimum salaries on the Pro Continental men's teams and certainly the World Tour teams, and they're significant. So we've got to push that and help provide the tools for the women. So it's good momentum. And I think we're seeing a lot of the European races are adding women's. Now they're adding TV to the women's races. And that's critical piece is that television or online streaming that you can actually watch the women race because it's excellent racing. And I think this last year in Europe, the numbers, and we'll get them soon, the numbers for the year, the TV numbers for the women's races that were in Belgium and Holland and some of those big races that they had were almost equal to the men's. That's where you can sell the sponsors. So for the Colorado Classic, you know, after 2 years of a men's and women's race, and really we started with 2 days of the 4 days in 2017. Then we had 4 days for the women in 2018, which I was glad and pushing for. And now, you know, the owners of the race RPM events group have decided, you know, the most efficient use and value for the money would be to do a women's only race. So we're going to have just a women's race. It'll be on the UCI calendar, 4 days. And the prize list will be more than the men's prize list was the last 2 years.
Awesome.
Yeah. And then we're also going to provide stipends to each team. And that's something that we really felt strongly about because the women's teams are so underfunded anyway. And by the time you get to August, you know, they're pretty much tapped out. So the top teams, the top riders are going to win the prize money. So if you make it bigger, that doesn't necessarily help everybody, but a stipend to every team helps everyone, and that helps the development of the sport. And so we'll do that. And obviously women's only allows us to make longer stages. And so we'll add more distance than they've been able to do the last couple of years. And obviously then, you know, better start times where normally the women get the short end of the stick. If they're going to race at 9 a.m, you know, the guys will race at something more reasonable later. So obviously it'll allow us to do a reasonable start time and everything, all the promotion, all of the marketing, everything we do will be directed towards promoting the women's event. And I think the most important aspect, and this is what I think we're kind of most proud of, is it will be available online every day, live through the app, the Tour Tracker app, and you'll be able to watch that race online. And again, I think for the teams, for the riders, for the sport, that's really one of the most significant pieces outside of the prize money, because that's what these teams need and that's what their sponsors need and the women to showcase that racing. So that we're excited about all the elements, but I think that one, again, to be able to showcase it and be able to for people to watch it, and you can watch it in Europe, you can watch it in the States, anywhere, is huge.
What are the days of that race?
August 22 to 25.
Coming up fast, Sean.
It is coming up fast. Yeah.
What are the different stage lengths?
We haven't really finalized yet. We're still working with the host cities, trying to nail down host cities. And so the women have, they have a max for a stage race, have a max of 160 kilometers.
Okay.
I don't know that, I don't know that we'll get to that, but at least we know where, what we can get to. And as opposed to, I think the whole 4 days of racing last year was probably less than 100 miles. And again, the men's was short too. So, you know, that's one of the things when you have men's and women's races, it's great because it's a full day of racing, but both groups really compromise. The men's are shorter than they want. And certainly the women's are shorter and times are, you know, you're, as I said, you're eating breakfast at 4 a.m. because you're going to race at, you know, 8:30 or something. So
how many teams?
We're expecting to invite about 20 teams.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Great
if
field.
We get 20, that'll be the biggest field in the States if we do that. So, yeah, six rider teams. And we got a lot of interest based on just our announcement, which is nice. Have interest from teams in Europe, which is what we wanted. It's tough because there's a women's world tour race in Norway that same weekend, which, of course, we knew. You know, we're blessed with really strong domestic teams. And obviously, you know, some of the best riders in the world are U.S. riders. We're going to have a strong field regardless of another big race in Europe at the same time.
So, Sean, do you have any parting thoughts to give to my listeners about cycling before I let you go, since I've already monopolized your whole afternoon?
No. I've been in it for this long because it's a beautiful sport. The athletes are amazing, the men and women, and ups and downs, and people we've struggled with, as we've talked about earlier, kind of the doping issues and races going away. But boy, at the end of the day, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous sport with some phenomenal athletes and wonderful people. And it's kind of one of the reasons I've stayed in it forever is the folks who are involved in the sport in general are pretty amazing people and inspirational. So it always keeps me going. But as I said, so I think, you know, despite what looks kind of cloudy and gray sometimes, you know, so the men's teams went away, but we always kind of go with these ebbs and flows, and I think we're going to continue to be relevant. If you love cycling, follow it, follow people, follow their social media accounts, because all those things count these days, and go to the races, buy stuff.
Buy my apples. You got it. Sean, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Sean Petty. He has so many hats, again, UCI, USA Cycling, this wonderful Colorado race for women. Good luck with that event. We will be watching it. I mean, we will be streaming watching it. And thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today.
Thanks, Diane. Appreciate it.
You have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Sean Petty joined me from his home in Colorado. The 2019 All-Women's Colorado Pro Classic will take place August 22nd through 25th. If you're interested in finding out more about the race, log on to coloradoclassic.com. My thanks to Sean for a great conversation, and thanks to Steve Frothingham for taking time to fill us in on the product recalls and how the government shutdown is affecting us in the bicycle world. Join me next week for a great chat with the Rivetress, Deb Banks. Deb is the owner of Rivet Cycles in California. She's the operations manager for the Sacramento Area Bicycle Advocates, Aranda News, and a lot more. We'll also talk again with Phil Guyman, retired pro, cookie monger, and the author of yet another fun book, Draft Animals. Thanks for listening. Please remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. Send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, and leave a comment on our blog at OutspokenCyclist.com. In the meantime, stay warm, have a great week, stay safe, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.